This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Super Bowl 53 is coming up this Sunday, and today we're taking a hard look at football and its social impact. For Lori Leachman's family, life centered on football. Her father, Lamar Leachman, was a former player with the Calgary Stampeders, later coached in the NFL and the CFL. Defensive line coach with the New York Giants when they won the Super Bowl in 1987, breaking my heart forever wide right. Later in his life, the family started to notice changes in his personality, including aggression and forgetfulness. Lamar was suffering from chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE. It's a degeneration of the brain. It's caused by repeated trauma to the head. Today is National CTE Awareness Day. Lori documents her father's journey as well as her own experiences in her book, Her Family Life, Growing Up. The book is called The King of Halloween and Miss Firecracker Queen, A Daughter's Tale of a Family and Football. Lori's a professor of economics at Duke University. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me, Frank. It's a pleasure to be here, especially today.
Let's talk about that and talk more about your father. Let's retell some of the story, and then we'll get into CTE and what you think should be done. Tell us more about your father and his career in football and what that meant for you as a young girl.
Well, my father was from Cartersville, Georgia, and was born in the back bedroom of a one-bedroom house. And football was his ticket to college. It was his ticket to a large life. So my dad won the Georgia State rushing record and held that record until the late 1970s when Herschel Walker won it. Herschel Walker went on to win a Heisman Trophy, which gives you some sense of my dad's talent. He then went on to play at the University of Tennessee. He was the last draft pick in the NFL in 1956, and that earns you the title of Mr. Irrelevant in football lore. He was drafted by Chicago, I believe, but I think he was cut and then went to Calgary to play for a year. And after a year, he was done with football because he really realized that his body had taken a beating. So then he went into high school coaching. From there, he coached college ball. From there, he went into the WFL, then the CFL, and ultimately the NFL. So he actually did the entire arc of football, which I didn't realize until I started writing the book. Nobody really does it like that anymore.
What was that life like for you? Because this book, your book, The King of Halloween and Miss Firecracker Queen, is really a memoir.
It is. It's about growing up in the South in a football family from a girl's perspective and a perspective on a really male-centric world. And for us, it was both exhilarating because, as I say, the next best thing to being a Baptist preacher in the South is being a football coach. basketball coach would also work here, I now know. So that was always an in for us and greased our entry into the social setting where we were. And that was a good thing because we lived in a different place almost every year. I went to a different high school every year growing up. And that is a really difficult thing for a young person, particularly a young girl.
Talk about his personality. He's certainly has accolades, and everybody who knows him knows it was larger than life.
My dad was really irreverent, completely politically incorrect. He was a very astute person with respect to personality and oddity. Okay, he really liked is not quite the right term, but could always sense the abnormal in someone. And I think a lot of that had to do with his upbringing because he was raised in this really religious, zealotly religious household. And so he was fascinated by things that were on the edge or outside of the norm. He loved to laugh. He was very intense. And he was relentless. And that is a blessing, and it's also a curse.
When did you and the family start noticing changes in his behavior?
We started noticing those in the early 90s, and at the time, my dad was in his early 60s. So he was young, and it was well before anybody was talking about CTE and its link to football. And at first, we thought he had had some surgery, a knee replacement, because he'd been hit on the sidelines and suffered a concussion. So we thought it was a holdover from the surgery, the anesthesia, and the hit to the head during the season. And then it never cleared up. And over time, it got progressively worse. And so, you know, in the beginning, it manifested in things like he couldn't find his keys. Well, you say, oh, I can never find my keys. But if you put them in the same place every day, you should be able to find them. If he went to a stadium that was not his home stadium, he couldn't figure out how to get into the stadium. Or once he was in there, he couldn't figure out how to get out. And that just snowballed over time. And after about probably 7 years, he could do his normal routine. He could drive to the places that he knew, and his normal routine included the gym and weightlifting and those sorts of things. Those were things he'd done all his life. But he could not manage any new situation whatsoever. New directions, new environment, new people would really make him come unglued.
Those cognitive changes, and you notice personality changes as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, everyone in football has aggression, or you wouldn't be in football. Right. And, you know, my dad was no different. And so, you know, over time, as he began to lose his cognitive function, he became much more angry. I suspect, Robert has made some reference to this in his book, he also suffered from real depression, though he would never say that. His aggression took the form mostly of verbal aggression. He would, you know, intimidate you physically, but he never raised a hand to any of us or anything like that. But he could, you know, lay you asunder with word and with his just his physicalness in your space.
And that was new. I mean, that was change.
Oh, that was really
change.
New. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So you went to Duke Neurological Disorders Clinic in the mid-2000s. What did they tell you was going on?
They told us that he had Alzheimer's and it was lifestyle induced. And what we took that to mean is that it was the byproduct of the blow to the head and drinking, because at that point my dad had become an alcoholic. And we were all very angry with him. We thought that this was a thing he was doing to himself through the drinking. And we didn't question the diagnosis. And so what happened is one day I was reading the New York Times and there was an article about a retired NFL player that had CTE. And it was like a 3-page article. So I'm reading it. I'm thinking, oh, my God, I'm living this. And I called my mother. I said, go get the paper. She read it. She was like, what is this? The next time we went into the neurological disorders clinic, I took it to the neurologist and put it on his desk. And I said, what about this? He said, that's exactly what he has. I just can't write that in his chart because we can only firmly diagnose it after death. But I know it's what he has because he also has Parkinson's. He has lower brainstem damage. He has neuropathy in his feet. All of these things are associated with repeated blow to the head.
The repeated part is something interesting, too, because you talked about the one blow on the sidelines. Then you come to find out there had been many, many more.
We found out that he had suffered at least 8 concussions that he knew of before the age of 22. And that means that most certainly there were more. And one at the age of 62, and then one again at the age of about 72. So clearly he had 10 documented concussions.
You're a member of a group called Women of the NFL who they support each other and share resources. What kind of stories are you hearing from that group?
Well, I can't tell you anything specifically because it is a private Facebook group, and that's intentional in order to make it a safe forum for women to share their information and share stories and ask for help. I can tell you generally that there's a lot of traffic on that, and the traffic centers around sports events. We're moving. Can you recommend? We've gotten traded. Or it is about physical ailments with respect to their spouses, how to access the settlement, how to get a diagnosis, what the treatment is, how to deal with depression, The fact that, you know, someone's spouse has a list, a daily list of things and can't get through anything other than the first thing on the list. How do people cope with that? Do they have strategies to help them? Are there apps that they can use? And so it's really a platform for information sharing and support for families that are suffering from the after effects or the continuing effects of a life in football.
Talked about the settlement. In 2013, the NFL agreed to pay out $765 million to settle a CTE lawsuit with retired players. So it's 6 years later, $765 million. Have players received that money? Is it out there doing
something? No. I mean, that's part of the discussion on this in this group is about what people's experience is and actually going through the process and accessing the money. It is a minuscule fraction of people that have applied that have so far been allocated funds. Now, it may be that there is a bottleneck in the in startup cost and getting this sort of system going. And it may be as the families share information, they become better at sort of accessing the system. But right now, it's been a really slow process. And the other thing I think that's really important to note about that is that if you started playing football, at professional football, after 2011, you're cut out of this settlement. And this is part of the reason that you're seeing young people that can walk away from the game. The guy that quit to go back to law school, the one that quit to get the PhD at MIT, those are guys that have options. They're playing a couple of years, making money to fund their graduate ambitions, and then they're out.
But talk about that, too, because that is having an interesting, there's an interesting social dynamic now as we know more about what the violence of football does to the human brain. There's now a real kind of a social divide among who plays and who does not play, right?
Well, there is, and I think that'll become bigger and bigger moving forward. I mean, just here in the Triangle in the last couple of years, East Chapel Hill and Chapel Hill High haven't been able to field a high school football team. Those are all educated, upper-middle-class families. They're not letting, they're making the choice not to let their children play. And they're making that choice because they have the ability to make that choice. And for a lot of families, what is in fact true is that football is their ticket for their kids' college education. I was at Georgia Tech in September and during football season and sold two books to parents of kids that play for Georgia Tech. And I asked them, how do you feel about that? And both parents said to me, it is my college my kids' college education. He will not play professional ball, but he wouldn't be here if he did play football. And so for a lot of families, football, they see, is their potential ramp to social mobility. And increasingly, that's going to be the case in the future, that those that don't have other options are going to opt in to this, and everyone else is going to walk away from it.
On the face of it, that would seem to mean less pressure on collegiate athletics and the and pro football to do much more about this, since there will be a steady supply.
I think the obligation, number one, starts at the NFL. And, you know, my dad never played in the NFL, though he did coach in the NFL. And a lot of people have asked me why, you know, I sort of focus on that. And my response to that is I've been at quality institutions and those that are not. And the difference between a quality institution and one that is not is the quality of leadership. And the top of the pyramid in football is the NFL. And so in my view, the NFL has got to own this more than the settlement and create a system that actually helps their personnel, their employees, moving forward as they transition into a different life, as they age, etc. And if the NFL were to say that this matters to us, it's a continuing, ongoing concern, colleges and universities would step up to that, and that would trickle down to the high schools. So I think you've got to set the ethic from the top.
Well, and in terms of that transition and the way they help, I mean, I think a lot of people feel that NFL players have a pension, they've got health insurance going forward, and that's not true for a lot of players.
It is not
right?
true for a lot of players, okay? There are a lot of retired players that played in the 60s, 70s, and 80s that have virtually no pension and no health insurance. okay, and accessing the actual health insurance that is there is not a simple process, and it is not everywhere available. So there are actual medical centers where the players go to be evaluated, and it's not, you know, in every city of the U.S. So what happens if you're retired and you don't have the funds to even travel to get there? You can't get the appropriate assessment to give you access to the settlement.
And you have to have played in the NFL for a certain level, a certain number of years before you even are eligible for health insurance.
Yes.
So that means you've been taking blows since high school, and they may have added up, and maybe you've only played 2 years in the NFL, but you're not on the insurance plan. That's the NFL side of it. Should the Players Association be doing more to represent?
I think the Players Association should be doing more, but Robert's book actually really helped me to understand the sort of inculcated weakness of the Players Association, that it's no surprise once they formed a union that these guys weren't their own best advocates because they haven't been taught to advocate for themselves moving through the system. Where else would you have a Players Association that actually gives the power to decide disciplinary issues to the head of the NFL? Where else would that happen?
And the divide between the best, the top players and the others means the solidarity, the question of solidarity is a little bit weak. The link is a little
right.
bit weak.
Right. Those that are, you know, on more long-term contracts, have been playing with a team in a system a long time, are a very different class of player than the journeyman player. Robert was really pretty much a journeyman player, and there's nothing for these guys.
Lori Leachman is the daughter of a former NFL coach, Lamar Leachman, also a professor of economics at Duke University. Her book is The King of Halloween and Miss Firecracker Queen, A Daughter's Tale of a Family and Football. And you can find links to our website, stateofthings.org. Lori, thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank.
Lori's going to be talking about her book this Sunday at Barnes & Noble at New Hope Commons in Durham and Malaprop's Bookstore in Asheville on February 5th. Also, the Barnes & Noble in Wilmington in March, and we've got that at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio.